Thank you. So first of all, I have to confess that I have stolen somebody's presenter just a few days ago, because I was thinking those were mine, but it turned out that mine was with Marcus Riegel, so feel free just okay. So everything is complicated. Anyways, today I'm not going to use my laptop. It will be a Blackboard talk about two numeric technologies which are different from each other, but very often come together. One is diagrammatic Monte Carlo, which is essentially a technology of sampling diagrams, and by diagrams I mean essentially any series of integrals which can be represented graphically. And Bohm algorithm, initially it was a kind of technology of sampling diagrams or any other configurations which can be represented by continuous lines. But in a broader context, Bohm algorithm is the idea about working in an extended space. So you have some space of configurations which you sample by Monte Carlo, but sometimes, very often actually, it's very very convenient to work in an extended space. When you extend your space and you gain at least performance, but very often some new an access to some new properties very relevant to physics. So let's start with defining what do I mean by a diagram, because in principle nowadays we are mostly doing diagrammatic sampling of the standard Feynman diagrams. But in a broader context, as I said, it's anything which can be represented graphically. So mathematically, I have some unknown quantity q of y. So it's an unknown function. Y are the variables of this function. And this function is represented by the following series of integrals. D, which I will be calling a diagram, stands for the integrand, for the function which is being integrated. And this function is a function of some m variables. I will just give a simple interpretation of this formula, and you immediately will see that in statistical physics we are often just mostly dealing with structures like that. So suppose we are doing a Polaron problem, or a single box problem. These are different problems, but mathematically, graphically, let's put it this way, they look pretty similar. They consist just these expansion for the Green's function for either Polaron or single box problem, and so on and so on. So in terms of the Polaron, this line stands for a propagating particle. Those guys are propagators of phonons. For a single box problem, it's basically the line describes the state of the particle in a single box, and those guys describe the interaction with the bath with the leads. So in terms of these variables which we integrate over here, say if we are talking of a Polaron problem, say in imaginary time and momentum representation, here we would have imaginary time and momentum, and so our y would be a set of momentum and, excuse me, and imaginary time, depending on representation. It can be actually anything. It can be coordinate and imaginary time. It can be momentum and frequency and so on. And within each diagram, we have both external variables, like our imaginary time, the global momentum, and also internal momenta and say imaginary times corresponding to these points. So those internal variables, in my case, imaginary times and momenta, are those axes. So my m here stands is for the total number, just a way of parameterization. Normally, physically, we define the order of diagram in terms of just, say, the number of lines. Here, I prefer to define it generically in terms of the number of internal variables. And this variable xi is a discrete variable which enumerates topologies. So the expression like that. And we need to do this stuff. So the difference between, say, analytics and what will I be doing next is that when we are doing analytics by diagram, we understand the integral. And for me, it will be important, it will be easier to think of a diagram as if it's this integrand. So just not only external variables, but also internal variables are supposed to be fixed. And this is the crucial idea of diagrammatic Monte Carlo, that whenever we have an integral like that, we can say, oh, why don't we just interpret this integral as averaging over certain distribution of certain objects. Suppose for a while that all these guys are positive definite. It's not fundamentally important, but just easier just to think of this stuff. So suppose these guys are positive definite. Then you say, okay, those guys can be interpreted as just distribution functions of some stochastic variables, those x1, xm, and also y. So all the variables are understood as stochastic variables, and the meaning, the interpretation of this expression would be that actually we sample the distribution q of y from a distribution of all possible variables, external and internal, and to sample, to find this quantity, we just need to generate, and you will see that it's at least conceptually very easy, we just need to generate this distribution. And then just histogram the quantity of interest, in our case the Green's function. And feel free to interrupt and ask questions if something is not clear, because it's just the main starting point. So we are going to sample the function of interest. Of course, the statistics will be not normalized, but as always, we know something. We know either some asymptotic behavior of this function, or we can include in our ensemble some known expression, so we will be simultaneously sampling our known function and some known expression, so the normalization is not a problem. So then, how would we normally do the sampling in such a case? In essence, it's a Metropolis algorithm, a certain generalization of Metropolis algorithm, because normally Metropolis algorithm or originally Metropolis algorithm was formulated either for a fixed number of continuous variables, in which case we would just shift them, or in terms of essentially discrete objects like stochastic series expansion, a set of discrete objects. So that's why people originally, if working, say, and instead of working in discrete imaginary time, people would try to discretize everything so that everything looks like a set of discrete configuration. It's not necessary. And basically, the idea of generating, the ensemble of diagrams is the following. We implement some elementary updates. So we start with something, say with this line, the starting point doesn't really matter. And we do some elementary, implement some elementary changes to our diagram. So what would be the easiest change? How, given a diagram, what can we do with the diagram just to produce a new one? Just add a propagator or remove a propagator. So that's the basic update. So I have a diagram, say like that, and I propose to add a new propagator. Say propagator like that. And this would be my update of the type A. And also I can start with the diagram like that and propose to remove one of the propagators. That would be my update of the type B. So normally in diagrammatic Monte Carlo, all updates come in the form of complementary pairs, because there is no symmetry. We either create some new continuous variables or just remove them. That's why A and B are complementary, but essentially different, because whenever we create a new propagator, we are supposed to ascribe new variables to it, say momentum and imaginary time. So with each new element, some amount of new variables come. So we can actually introduce a letter x, a vector x, which in our case will be k naught, tau sub a and tau sub b. A vector x standing for new variables which we are supposed to generate. And when we remove this propagator, we just remove it, so no extra variables are involved. We just erase it, like here. And that's basically a slight difference with the standard metropolis, these variable number of continuous variables. But the final prescription is pretty much the same as with metropolis. So the key point, so if we want to generate the right balance, we are supposed first to propose an update, like let us do this update with some tau A, some tau B, and some k naught. And then we either accept or reject this proposal. And of course, the balance, the physics, is all about the probability with which we accept or reject this stuff. And as you can guess, the probabilities are somehow the probabilities to accept the process A and the probability to accept the process like B should somehow be related to these functions D, which stand for the integrand, and something else. So normally it's easy to figure out that there should be a ratio of the new diagram, if we are dealing with the update of the type A, we have some previous variables and we add some new ones, and the old diagram, which depends on X naught, the previous set of variables, and something is lacking here, which we will discuss.
Or is little all the change that just changes the values of one of the internal variables?
Say it again.
What about the change update that just changes, does not add the line, but just changes the values of...
Oh, very good question. For example, if we want to sample this variable y, in our case it would be tau.
No, internal variables. So even internal variables.
Oh, even internal. You can do it easily. Normally, in terms of the internal variable, normally you don't need to do it, because it happens automatically. Because you see, when you generate new internal variables and erase them, you automatically sample. So it's basically the beauty of this technology. In terms of internal variables, you don't really need to care about shifting them. Though you can introduce an update which would change their values. It could be a standard metropolis of 1953. You can do it. So. But it's not necessary. That's the point. So just the crucial point is updates like that. We change this number.
Why is that not necessary? Because you are integrating over those variables, right? So you should be. I mean, You need the values.
I am integrating automatically. So the diagrammatic Monte Carlo does the integrals automatically, because changing the topology and changing the internal variables happens automatically. That's how I integrate over them, because the integration is sort of implicit. The very fact that, as I said, the integration is interpreted as the averaging over the ensemble. Once my ensemble, which I generate by this Markov process, is representative, the integration is automatically done. The integration is just the averaging.
To change tau A and tau B, then it's all about removing a line and then adding it back to another different position.
Exactly. So, because in this experiment, something is lacking. You will see that your question is directly related to what is lacking here. Okay. Okay. And if we do it other way around, so if you erase, the thing, the new and old interchange. And now comes your question, and actually first come my observation. So if would these guys be discrete objects? No, integration, everything would be fine. It would be just Metropolis algorithm, with the reservation that if this probability is larger than unity, we just accept the update with probability 1. But something is definitely wrong if something should be added. Because you see the dimensionality. It's not the dimensionality of probability, because those guys' axes, they're dimensional. So if I do just the ratio of integrands, this guy cannot be probability, it's dimensional. But as you asked, something is lacking here, because somehow I put here my new variable, but I don't tell how do I get it. And that's basically the essence of diagrammatic Monte Carlo. I am supposed to generate my new variables. I'm supposed to throw dice, say three times, once for generating tau sub A, the next time to generating tau sub B, and finally to generate this guy, with a certain distribution, which is absolutely speaking theoretically, up to me. Because if I use these relations, which can be easily derived from the standard theory of just Markov chain in 10 minutes, then you will see that everything is balanced no matter what is the value of this function which I use to seed my new variables, provided, of course, that everything is ergodic and with a finite probability I have an access to all variables. So what does depend on the value of this function? Who can guess? The performance. Only the performance depends. Because if I'm doing something stupid, if I'm proposing something non-physical, both guys will be very small. So one of the guys will be very small because of the smallness of this guy, and in terms of the physical configurations. And the other guy will be small because of the ratio. So the rule of thumb here is that we are supposed to find such a function W, which on one hand is simple, so that we can easily do numerics, easily seed the variables, so that it's not actually a pain to generate something, a headache. But on the other hand, this ratio should be reasonably close to unity. So if it's 10 to the minus 3, it's too bad. If it's, say, 50% or 30%, it's perfect. That's the prescription. Okay, so if everything is more or less clear, so this is the generic scheme, and the only observation I want to make that apart from Feynman diagrams, we can do some other stuff which also satisfies this definition. For example, yes, question.
Just a naive question. Okay. Typically, when you look at these diagrammatic expansions, they are complex numbers.
Oh, very good.
So what do you do with that?
Okay, let me just directly answer your question. So, speaking theoretically, if my function is not positive definite, say suppose I have function which is not positive definite, which is like that, some function of some variable, Speaking theoretically, I can always represent my function as a difference of two positive definite functions, right? So that would be my f plus, that would be my f minus. And I would say, okay, then the answer is just the difference. But this is the notorious sign problem, which severely depends on the structure of the configurational space. So if we are doing stuff like that, this problem is relatively mild, so it doesn't kill us. We just do it. And with fermions, it's just the standard case that those expansions are not positive definite. But in this case, because the typical number, say the typical order of the diagram, say 7 or 9, so the typical number is not macroscopic, in which case we can survive just the same problem. If we are simulating the chunk of matter, and I'm going to describe basically yet another representation, the path integral representation. With path integral representation, when we simulate a chunk of matter and the number of our continuous variables is macroscopic, the same problem immediately kills us. So speaking formally, we still can represent the answer in terms of the integral, but because of this stuff, so basically, speaking practically, the sign becomes unabsorbable. So you, instead of doing with diagrams, you sample the absolute values of them and say, okay, and sign should be added to my observable, being averaged. But as a result, physics would be embedded in, say, 7th or, I know, 12th digit of the expression, meaning that we will be sampling essentially noise rather than answer. So this is the notorious sign problem.
Another naive question. If your perturbation theory catalogs a lot of keys, so would that be seen in this diagrammatic
It's a very reasonable question, and even more serious question is not even the sign problem and infrared divergence, because if there is some divergence in a single diagram, you can always introduce a cutoff at the expense of controllable systematics. Studying your final answer as a function of your cutoff, you can still proceed, right? So your answer will be a function of a cutoff, and then you will set your cutoff to zero in the final answer. But what if the series doesn't converge at all? So, and that basically was the reason why we... So all this stuff we just... Nikolai Prokofiev, myself, and Igor Tupitsin, we realized all this stuff more than 10 years ago in 98. But somehow we had a sort of mental blocking that it will not work for fermions or just any macroscopic system because of the Dyson's collapse argument, essentially saying that in most of the cases, Feynman's diagrams is an asymptotic series with zero convergence radius, meaning that it's physically senseless. But first of all, for many fermionic systems, like fermions on the lattice, the convergence radius is finite, meaning that with some that at least you have finite convergence radius, and also you can do boldification. You can do Dyson boldification. You can work with bold lines, and all this technique is perfectly compatible with diagrammatic Monte Carlo. You basically can sample Green's functions through themselves and converge nicely. With fermions in a continuous space, you can always regularize them by introducing, say, upper momentum. Once again, at the expense of controllable systematics, everything works. So the bottom line is, and also just if you look at Nikolai's talk a few weeks ago here, we know how to proceed with bosons and classical fields already. Once again, at the expense of controllable systematic errors. So you regularize your system so that it's free from Dyson's collapse. Finite convergence radius, at least finite convergence radius appears, and then you can rely on resummations and stuff. But resummation is a very important word in all this diagrammatic technology. So, okay. So just I want...
First,
yes?
Sorry, but I just want to make sure is this mass is still based on the perturbative expansion?
Not necessarily, because here we are dealing with perturbative expansion. But so the method itself is just the method of sampling a series of integrals.
You put someone like the m runs over from 0 to infinity, but in real practice, you probably have to make a cutoff.
Right? Yeah, it depends. So the technology depends. So if you are dealing with a convergent series, like in the Polaron problem, you don't even care about m, because the series is convergent, and basically you press the button and computer itself decides how big should be M. If the series converges only if you take into account the sign of the diagram, so it's not an absolute convergence, but it's convergence when the sign is taken into account, you should be more accurate. You should actually truncate your expansion to a certain order and then see how things evolve. And as I said, with finite diagrams, it's important to enhance the convergence by resummation. So it's you not only truncate this series, but you do resummation, which in essence is introducing some extra factors here and basically summing with those extra factors. And then you see how your answer evolves with the truncation. If you see that it saturates, then it's okay. And normally the main, the most tough part of the problem is not the answer itself, but the error bar, because you would simulate higher diagrams, and basically this is the toughest with the sign problem, just to make sure that you saturate it to the final answer. Okay, so let me just give yet another graphical representation of that type, which is path integral representation for a discrete system. Now, if we have some lattice model, and here my model is one dimensional, J is the lattice side, and so here is my space, discretized space, and here is my imaginary time. And as we know, the partition function for a quantum system can be represented by Feynman's paths, which for a discrete system consist of continuous lines like that. And we immediately see that this partition function, we have to sample over all configurations of that type, and we immediately see that we are dealing with the integral like that, in which case our axes are just moments of imaginary time at which we have kinks. The positions of the kinks completely parameterize the diagram like that, and we just need to sample them. So that's why originally and very often those methods are called continuous time methods. But as you see, continuous time methods form just a subclass of this generic continuous variable approach. So now I want to discuss the norm algorithm, because apart from, say, the convergence problem, which is not an issue here, if we simulate a chunk of matter, there is no problem with convergence. A part of the sign problem, which will be there if we are talking of fermions, because with fermions, just interchanging two word lines, those guys are called word lines or Feynman's paths, immediately change the sign of the whole thing, and that's how this method does work for fermions. There is yet another problem, the problem of topological constraints. So let me describe this problem and introduce the Bohm algorithm through describing this problem. So actually, all the word lines for bosons, either in continuous space or discrete space, are supposed to be closed. This is because actually this expression for the partition function comes from doing the trace of the statistical operator And the trace is symmetric with respect to cyclic permutation, so there are no ends. So actually we start from 0 point in imaginary time, we end up at point beta, which is the inverse temperature. But there is nothing special about zero and beta. Everything lives on a torus with respect to imaginary time. And actually it's very convenient to have periodic boundary conditions in real space, because this allows us to sample the superfluid response through a very elegant formula derived by Pollock and separately. Let me just describe this formula. So if we are thinking of superfluidity or some phase transitions associated with superfluidity, the quantum phase transitions or classical phase transition, we would look for at this quantity, superfluid stiffness, which enters the effective action for long range fluctuations of the phase, or the field of the phase, because superfluidity is all about the phase in D dimensions. So this temperature and S is so-called superfluid stiffness, or just phase stiffness, because it can be anything, not necessarily superfluid. And no matter whether the problem is quantum or classical, because for the classical problem in the seminary reciprocity class, we can also implement high temperature expansions, and the result, if the system is discrete, and the result would be also some configuration in terms of oriented continuous line. So it doesn't really matter whether we are dealing with quantum or classical system. And Pollock and Seppele established a very elegant formula for this quantity in terms of the so-called word line winding numbers, which I am going to introduce. So L is the system size, D is dimensionality. So what is the winding number? So suppose I have just one particle, and I'm doing the partition function using this Feynman's decomposition of the trace. Then for a single particle in a system with periodic boundary conditions, I can have a line like that living on this torus, but also I can have a line like that, which winds, around my torus, because you see there are no free ends of the line. Everything is consistent with doing the trace. But we see that those are different topological classes, and this is precisely what is meant by the winding number. Here it's 0, here it's plus 1. In the opposite direction it would be minus 1, and as I said, we have an elegant formula which directly relates the variance of those windings to the superfluid stiffness and the inverse temperature and the system size.
Yes. What's the averaging of all configurations?
Say it again?
The variance.
Yes.
Averaging there. What's the averaging is over what?
Averaging over all possible configurations of the word lines. Because you see this mapping, so it's a good question. So when we map, when we map quantum statistic onto this classical type statistic, onto the polymers, it's not like a configuration of polymers represents some state of quantum system. It's the statistics of the polymers which represents the statistics of our quantum system. So we really need to average over the statistics of those polymers. Only doing that we can read out the superfluid response of the quantum system. Because the expectation value of W is just zero, right? So just the most typical value would be just zero. But to measure the superfluid response, we need to do many, many, many different observations to see what's the variance. Okay? And that's basically the translation from the language of polymers into the language of superfluidity. It's very interesting that it's a sort of duality when long range order, because superfluidity is all about long range order. Long range order for bosonic system corresponds to essentially chaos of polymers, because without having a chaos of polymers, if the guys are like that, if we have a crystal, windings are zero. Okay? A crystal without vacancies and interstitials to be accurate, because otherwise it can be a super solid. So now we have a problem actually, because if we implement some local updates, which I described before, which in this language could be updates, say like that, we see that updates like that do not change this winding number and do not give us then the schema is not ergodic. We cannot go from this stuff to this one. It was a major problem, by the way, in simulating helium, because all changes from here to here were sort of very exponentially rare in terms of the system size events. But we can use a trick. This trick is actually extension of our configurational space. So along with those configurations, which are continuous and contribute to physical partition function, we can introduce the configurations where we have two ends, lines with two ends. Actually, those configurations are not unphysical. They just correspond to a different physical object. They correspond to the Green's function. So if X is the space-time point, then those lines represent the creation and annihilation operators at two space-time points. And the idea is to simultaneously simulate configurations which contribute to the partition function and configurations which contribute to the numerator of the Green's function. So if we introduce the Green's function as the following correlator, then it has its numerator and it has its denominator, which is essentially the partition function z, and for the numerator we have those diagrams, and for the denominator we have the diagrams which I described before without free ends. And if we introduce an extended configurational space such that both diagrams are allowed, so that there is a z configurational space corresponding to the denominator, there is G configurational space corresponding to the numerator, we will immediately get a freedom to go from this sector to that one by doing the following. So if we start, say, in the Z sector, where there are no free ends, we can do an update of the following type. So we can introduce either a piece of word line, or we can introduce, that's one option, so the update which either introduces or erases. As I said before, we have complementary pairs, so one update of the pair creates a piece, another one erases it, or we can introduce a gap in the word line, and once again we have two complementary updates, one introduces a gap, another one just erases the gap. So this way we can go by two pairs of update between the sectors of our configurational space. But the main job of updating configuration and sampling the windings will be done over here in this sector G. So here we have all the freedom, no constraints, because we have free ends. we can propagate those free ends, and just you can easily see that if we propagate free ends here, we introduce new kinks or erase new kinks. So it's all in the context of general scheme of diagrammatic Monte Carlo, when we either introduce new continuous variables, new times, or remove them. And the most important update, most non-trivial update, which actually works wonders, is the update when we do a reconnection. Reconnection of this line with this worm, so this guy is called worm, with some neighbor, with some neighboring line. So the update takes us from this configuration, probably I just write yet another one to see what happens. So it takes me from this configuration to the following one. And you see that what happens, I dramatically change the topology of the whole thing, because all of a sudden, just a piece of this line gets attached to the piece of that line. And this explains why actually this algorithm is really, really efficient, and it significantly suppresses the critical slowing down. For all practical purposes, say if we are doing the U1 universality class or other things with superfluid phase transition, this scheme is extremely efficient. And even if we do, say, classical Ising model with this scheme, it's more efficient in 3D at least than the special purpose cluster updates. This is because this worm, this pointwise object, immediately forgets about its tail when we do an update like that. It behaves like a pointwise random walker, which actually processes the configuration, like worm processes the soil. And basically, that's the general idea of the worm algorithm. So if we add, say, more colors, if we are studying, say, multi-component bosons in an optical lattice, and if we care about counterflow orders, say the orders like that, those are counterflow orders provided all those guys, all single particle condensates are zero. So we have, say, some finite number of colors. If the number of colors is 2, this can be mapped on magnetism, on magnetic problem. But if the number of colors is 3 and more, it's a problem on its own. So
you want this to be non-zero, right? Because you want this to be non-zero.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yes, sorry. So this stuff is non-zero. So it's essentially a pairing between particle of one component and the whole of the other component, provided we have some integer filling factor, say filling factor 1. Then we suppress the net flow of particles. It's just standard mode physics, but still can have this counterflow when particles exchange the position. And in this case, the structure of the worm should be different, because a single worm, a worm and a single component, will not do the job because of this situation. So these orders, the stiffness in each in each counterflow channel should be actually gently assessed by the following type of the worm. So if it's component 1, it's the particle of the component 1, then there will be a hole of component 2, and that's basically the worm which should be propagated. So we have to introduce, in addition to all other sectors, if we really want to sample this order, because we could be interested in phase transition between counterflow states and, say, condensate states. So we need actually much more sectors. But the crucial point is that to efficiently sample those orders, we would need a worm like that. So we would have to propagate two locked ends along the system. And finally, let me tell you how the idea of this room, the idea of working in an extended configurational space can be applied and actually is applied to Feynman diagrams in momentum representation. Because actually I swept under the carpet some constraint which we have if we work in the momentum representation. This constraint is the conservation of momentum. So suppose I have some diagram, some multiparticle diagram like that. So this is interaction. Those are propagators. This is yet another interaction. And I was telling you that my typical update would be to remove a propagator. So let's try to remove this propagator, which had a momentum Q. So if I just naively remove this propagator, I would be left with two lines. But I had four, and I had actually four different momenta, and everything was nicely conserved. But if I just remove this line, I'm in trouble, because then I don't know which momentum should be ascribed to this line. Okay? And the way out is to extend the configurational space by saying the following. Let's ascribe momentum K1 here and momentum K2 here, and we immediately see that then we have a problem with two points, this one and this one, because the momentum would be conserved here if we would have an extra momentum Q entering this vertex, and the same, it's important, momentum Q exiting these vertex. So we get rules, we get something which is not physical but very helpful in terms of the updating strategy. Because if we allow for yet another sector, so physical sector and the warm sector, we can actually do all the updates with these two rooms. Because you see, when we have these two rooms, and it's important that it's always like that, so it's the conservation or non-conservation of momentum can be always represented by yet another fake non-physical line connecting the vertices. So we can see that once we have these two rooms, we can easily insert propagators at the lines adjacent to those rooms. We can go back, actually. We can go back with erasing the room. So, and then we can propagate the room. So once we have the room here, we can actually make one step and move it over here. So this vertex will be consistent with the conservation of momentum. The problem will be this. Actually, not the problem, it's just the room will be here. All those rooms can actually travel along the diagram. Then they can cancel each other. Returning back to the physical sector and so on and so on. So it's the same idea. It's the same idea of working in the extended configurational space when most of the non-trivial updates are done in a non-physical sector. And from time to time, we get back to the physical sector just to do measurements. So I would say that
one or several of these forms.
Two. Sure. We cannot have one, because you see, and so we have this guy and this guy, and because see what happened, we had sort of loop carrying momentum Q, and when we remove this loop, we automatically create two guys. And it's just yet another way to see it. So suppose we have a nice diagram like that, and we want to create one. What do we actually do to create a pair of worms? Is we just change the momentum. And let's replace this guy with some other momentum, Q wiggle. And then we automatically create this complementary pair, because basically then it will be Q minus Q wiggle, which will be a problem. And once again, how do we annihilate these guys? We just restore the original Q. We say when those guys see each other with a distance of one propagator, we just replace this fake Q with the physical one, and the worm disappears. So that's it.
Plenty of time for questions.
I have a question for the diagrammatic part. You have shown one move, which is to take a line or put
yes.
a line. This looks like a single move procedure. Could you have more lines, many lines taken, so that you really drastically change the kind of diagrams you're looking?
Well, the wisdom with Monte Carlo is the less the number of the lines, the better. Because you see, you really want, because if you do many lines, normally you would end up with something non-physical. It's so-called macro update. The main problem is that when you do something arbitrary, unless you know some magic rule like with cluster updates, unless you know some magic rule for some special system, you can play this game just by doing something dramatically different. But in a general case, you would prefer to minimize the number of variables you are dealing with at a time. Because otherwise, the acceptance ratio will get very small.
But essentially, that means that you have kind of a single move, and that you could have some metastabilities, that you cannot visit some other diagrams, which maybe are important, but
why? Why? It's ergodic. It's absolutely ergodic. There is no problem. It's absolutely ergodic. Why not?
I don't know. I mean, if you cannot, if you always change us by one line,
yes,
is the question whether you can visit some other diagrams, which
definitely. Moreover, some problem can happen. Let me just formulate some problem. So suppose we are sampling actually our self energy, because normally we sample self energy, not the Green's function. It's technological stuff, just to minimize the number of diagrams. And for self-energy, the diagrams are supposed to be irreducible. Suppose by removing something, you generate a reducible diagram. Now you can say, okay, it's a bad move. Let's not do it. But in terms of the efficiency, you can say, why don't we just do it? It's once again this idea of generalized configurational space for the sake of efficiency. You say, okay, let's do this update, because we are not going to measure this diagram. So whenever it's non-physical, it comes with a factor of zero when it comes to measurement. So that's basically the answer to your question. So if you have some problem with ergodicity, you can extend your space of diagrams, and then it does. But normally it's all about lower order diagrams. With high order diagrams, everything is nicely connected to each other.
There's also the reconnectivity, right, which changes the topology quite dramatically.
I didn't list all the others. I actually asked Zhenya for the details, because it's actually the person with Chris, they actually realized it for Ferenc. Because to tell you the truth, conceptually everything is simple, but programming takes time. So, but there is yet another important update when you take two lines and just two propagators and interchange them. It's also very efficient.
But ergodicity and metastability are two pairs of shoes, not the same thing. Ergodicity and metastability, so the question that was raised, there are two different things. You know this from classical Monte Carlo all the time.
Right.
You're very ergodic. Still, you're trapped in metastable state. So
yes. So
in the phase space of your diagram, you know, a similar thing can happen, and it's not clear that extending in one way or the other will.
Okay, let us put it this way. So if we are, say, simulating some glassy system with path integrals, of course some macroscopic update may be more efficient. But talking of Feynman's diagrams, we haven't seen, at least for simple systems like Hubbard model or resonant fermions, we haven't seen any problem with metastability. we do see some problem with just not very efficient updates, but it's basically our problem. Management is important. So as I mentioned, this function W should be properly chosen, and basically the set of updates, because actually the set of updates is not just adding propagator. Jenny mentioned this interchanging, and we do something else. So it's just to introduce you to the idea. Actually, the set of our updates is a bit larger. But it's just, in essence, it's all about rooms, propagators, reconnections and stuff, and so far we didn't see any problem with meta stability. But then, of course, if there is some problem with meta stability, then probably doing some macro update would do the job.
We're extending configuration space even further.
Or extending configuration space even further. Yes.
Sometimes more.
Yes, because normally, yes, meta stability can be associated with a sort of wall. For example, say you're doing glassy bosons, and the problem is that you want to take, say, a particle from here and put it somewhere else. See how ROM helps, because you have a particle here and you want to translocate it over there in this Z configurational space, and you have potential barrier. But with the ROM, what you do, you just introduce a gap, you erase the whole thing over here, and you draw it over here without even seeing the barrier. So Jenny is absolutely right. So extending configuration space can be even better than just, I don't know, doing this brute force macro update with low acceptance ratio.
So if I understand correctly, so the worm algorithm, the fast interval case, I know that the worm move is complete, so you only need that one sample of the whole phase space. But in your diagram, version of the worm algorithm instead, that's not enough.
Of course, because the worm with diagrammatics, the worm does not change the topology of the diagram at all. The worm, when we move the worm itself without doing anything else, we just change the momenta which we ascribe to the internal lines. But the worm is very helpful because if we combine it with adding and removing propagator or reconnecting the lines, as Jenny mentioned, then it's the combination actually which is very efficient, not the worm itself.
But you could think of introducing two momentum discontinuities that somehow merge when you introduce a propagator.
That's what we are doing. We introduce momentum discontinuity. It's exactly...
That would change the number of propagation lines and so on. I mean, I don't know, I just...
I didn't get the point. So if you formulate the update,
I've never seen it.
Okay, just formulate the update and we will discuss it. Okay.
Hans. Two questions. One, when you extend configuration space in several ways, then at first the interesting part that you actually want to calculate can become very small relative to the other. So you probably have to introduce some weight.
It's a good question. So normally with point-wise ROMs, it doesn't happen. We tried once to do compact electrodynamics, which is all about closed surfaces, not lines, by introducing a kind of generalization of the ROM, which was a kind of surface with three ends. It was not efficient at all. So it's important actually that the ROM here is a point. If it's something else, it can be not very efficient.
There are some cases where one needs several worms at once and then one needs to re-weighting there.
With a few worms it can be okay. For example, if you are studying a two or three component system, you would normally have sectors with the number of worms equal to the number of components in principle. So with few worms it's okay. Because once again, you see, you do not need to measure, so you have a macroscopic configuration. you don't want to measure each step, because you see, if you do a single update having, I don't know, 1 million parts, you're still there, you didn't change anything. You really want to measure when your configuration is essentially new. And it's basically the time which the worm takes just to travel along the system. So before we really need to measure, before the configuration, it's the notion of a sweep is important. A sweep is a kind of update of everything. So actually, the typical time which Rome needs just to do the job is one sweep. So it's self-consistent and balanced in this sense.
Second question, how do you do bold diagrams?
Bold diagrams, very good question. So basically, it's absolutely the same. The technology is absolutely the same, because suppose we start with some expansion, which is purely perturbative, and our coupling, say, is small, and we sample our propagator. And then we just start using, so whenever we introduce the propagator, instead of using the bare propagator, we use what we measured in our histogram. We start plugging the result of our measurement, because it doesn't really matter whether you use an analytic function or some numeric function which you just sample. Okay? And then comes the tricky. We slowly increase the coupling so that the difference between bare and bold becomes more and more pronounced. And we keep accumulating statistics. You can say, oh, we introduced the systematics because we started with something which was irrelevant. So in our histogram, we have contributions which were coming from different coupling. That doesn't seem nice. But then we need to recall that the statistical error of Monte Carlo scales like 1/√ of time. Yeah. Right? That's the statistical error of sampling. And if you collect everything into the histogram starting with something irrelevant, so it's statistical error. But this systematic error due to our starting point, which was irrelevant, will be scaling like 1/time, because we keep accumulating our histogram. The number of events in our histogram which we use to sample this Green's function is proportional to time. That's why the initial irrelevant contributions or marginal contributions would die away like 1/time. So in the statistical limit, it doesn't really matter that we started with something not physical.
How do you use histogram?
So Monte Carlo is all about histogramming, right? Green's function is being histogrammed. So we have, say, momentum, imaginary time, and what's being measured is the following. So we have our configuration, say for the Green's function for simplicity. So we have our instant time and instant momentum. And when we measure, we just add yet another point in the bin. So everything is binned, and whenever we measure, we add a point to the bin. We decide if we are dealing with fermions, but it's a detail. So we add points to the bin. And our Green's function is essentially this histogram. This is a histogram, a two-dimensional histogram. For the Green's function of k and tau. So the Green's function is being sampled out of the distribution of tau and k. We sample the distribution of tau and k, and that's how we know what our Green's function is. And then using this histogram, which defines the function, whenever we do the diagram, we use this function obtained from this histogram for the weighting factor which we use for doing this line. So you see, it evolves in time. So it's not a Markovian process. Strictly speaking, it's asymptotically Markovian process, because this guy which enters the diagrams is being changed, not only because of statistical noise, but also because we start with something which was not a correct answer, but it converges. It converges step by step, it converges. Or normally it converges. And so far we didn't see any divergence. So just we keep. So just the thermalization process corresponds to just increasing the coupling constant. So we start with something at lower coupling constant and go to higher coupling constant. Well, accumulating statistics. Does it make sense? Okay.
All right. Next time, Boris, please.